WMMC HD3 Detroit, KMPS HD3 Seattle, WBMX HD3 Boston,
and on AOL Radio
and Yahoo Launchcast.
Welcome, everyone. My guest tonight is Dr. Chandra Wickramasinghe. He is acknowledged as one of the world's leading experts on interstellar material and the origins of life. Since on this show we often talk to guests who have experienced encounters with beings assumed to be of extraterrestrial origin or have witnessed UFOs, my guest tonight will hopefully bring some fresh insights on the topic of extraterrestrial life from his background as a scientist. The professor has rocked the scientific world by his unusual and controversial theories about the content of cosmic dust. Basically, he first proposed in 1974 that dust in interstellar space and in comets is actually mostly organic, made of living matter. The professor, who was born in Sri Lanka, now lives in Britain and currently serves as the director of the Buckingham Center for Astrobiology. He is also an adjunct professor at Ruhuna University in Sri Lanka, honorary professor at the University of Buckingham, honorary professor at the University of Glamorgan in Wales, and professor of applied mathematics and astronomy at Cardiff University in Wales. Professor Wickramasinghe has one of the most distinguished careers I've ever seen. He's written over 30 books and 350 scientific papers. He's also an award-winning poet. In 1986, he received the International Dag Hammarskjöld Gold Medal for Science, and in 1992, he was decorated by the President of Sri Lanka with the titular honor of Vidya Jyoti. He's a former advisor to the President of Sri Lanka. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and also a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society. He holds the highest doctorate degree in science from the University of Cambridge in England, and also an honorary doctorate from Soka University in Tokyo, Japan. So welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you.
So, you know, I have to, well, you know what, first of all, I'm just going to say, I think this is probably a very timely interview, because I know that you've got a very large birthday coming up in a couple of weeks.
That's right, yeah.
And you're going to be 75, that's okay to say, on air.
Yeah.
And you've got a new autobiography that's just come out, A Destiny of Cosmic Life. You want to just give just a quick explanation of what's in the book?
Well, it's a story of my life that is essentially traces all the ideas that I developed over a period of about 40 or 50 years. And I start with my childhood, in which I really became extremely passionately interested in science, then on to university in Sri Lanka, and then on to Cambridge, where I met up with the legendary astronomer of the last century, Sir Fred Hoyle, and started this long collaboration on interstellar dust and life in the cosmos and so on, that led up to my present situation of believing that there is life everywhere in the universe. And that's something that is not just a belief in me at the moment. I think I have provided, along with a sort of team of colleagues worldwide, unequivocal proof that this is so, that there is life everywhere. Extraterrestrial life is a fact, and we still haven't got used to extraterrestrial life of any kind, let alone UFOs. I think even humble microbial life is being as an entity that we have to sort of accommodate in our thinking, which to me is absolutely bizarre. So this is the story that I've written up in the book. It's more or less a personal life story, but through the descriptions that I've given, the science also emerges.
Yeah, and I think it's absolutely fascinating what you're saying, and I think it's important for our listeners to understand exactly what you said, which is that this concept of extraterrestrial life, even on the microbial level, is so difficult for people to wrap their heads around, and there's so much resistance to the concept, even in the face of scientific evidence.
Yeah, the scientific evidence has grown to a point that is, to me, is absolutely compelling. And yet there are a substantial number of distinguished scientists who go along with that point of view to accept that there is such evidence. But the bulk of the so-called major establishments in science, like NASA, for instance, insist on denying it. And there's one very interesting incident that I got involved in recently, because my old friend from many years is Dr. Gilbert Levin, who led the Viking Mars expedition in 1976. He lives in New York, and he's a very distinguished scientist, a very distinguished academic. He was the principal investigator of the program that sought to detect life on Mars in 1976. And he obtained evidence that, to me and to him and to a large number of people, appeared to be quite strong, proving that there was microscopic life forms currently on Mars. Right, but this was not accepted for some reasons that turned out to be, eventually turned out to be wrong. What they did in the experiment was to pour the kind of nutrient that bacteria like to take up, right? Okay, like soup or agar. They poured this onto the soil of Mars, and the nutrient was taken up, and the whole thing frothed like a sort of a can of Coke or something. It really frothed furiously. And from that experiment, Gil Levin concluded that this was a positive for life. But there was a second experiment in which they tried to look for chemicals that are organic chemicals around the landing site. And the equipment was rather primitive at the time, and they could not find a positive signal for the organics. And despite the fact that there was this stunning result of the whole sort of nutrient being taken up and so on, NASA decided to back off from the conclusion, and at the time they said this was inconclusive, that the results were not conclusive. Now, since then, since 76, there have been dozens of expeditions that have gone to Mars. There's a rover now called Curiosity that is roaming around the surface of the planet and doing all sorts of experiments. But there's not a single life detection experiment. But some of the results that were published and put out on the internet have shown that there are green patches on some of the rocks. And my colleague and friend Gil Levin has asked NASA to disclose what these green patches are. He has sort of brought into action with this act of U.S. law called the Freedom of Information Act.
Right? Yes, I'm familiar with it.
Where you demand the information that is arrived at from public spending on science. And so this is pending now. He's sent this, and we don't know what the outcome would be. But, I mean, the long and short of the story is that there has been, from 1976, evidence that should have pointed to current life on Mars. And yet now, with all the experiments that have been done currently, there's not a single experiment or a single statement that's been made to say that there may be life now on Mars. All they're doing is to look for perhaps evidence of ancient life, evidence of water that has flowed in rivers in the past, but not life currently on Mars. So that's Mars. But going further than that, there's also really compelling evidence that there is life outside the Earth. In fact, in the middle of last year, my colleague in Sheffield, Milton Wainwright, and myself and some students, we sent up equipment in a balloon to 30 kilometers above the surface of the Earth. And that's a very great height in terms of terrestrial heights. And we picked up material that is falling in from space. And this was brought down to the Earth, and we have discovered some bizarre organisms, and they're unquestionably alien microorganisms. We published these results in a journal called the Journal of Cosmology. So the evidence is mounting almost day by day. The evidence for life not only existing outside the Earth, but coming into the Earth from outside. So
all right, so you've jumped the gun a little bit on some of my questions here, which I absolutely was going to... No, that's fine. I want to go back to why you think NASA would possibly be withholding information that might be very critical in showing that there is life on Mars, even if it's in the microbial form. Why would they do that? And aren't we at risk now, after many more landings, of there being contamination from Earth?
That's the unfortunate thing now, because we've sent all these missions to Mars since 1976, and they have not been sterilized to the extent that would remove every possible microorganism from the Earth. So unwittingly, we have taken microbes to Mars. Unfortunately, the missions that have gone to Mars since 1976 have not been properly sterilized or completely sterilized. And so I believe it is inevitable that we have taken Earth organisms to Mars. And whether these have actually taken root on Mars is a question, but I think there is now a possibility that whatever we find on Mars may be Earth contaminants. But the 1976 experiment was pristine, and the data still exists. It's in the public domain. It's in for everybody to look at, and so we have to demand that there's more action taken in regard to the 1976 data. But I think much more interesting than life on Mars is life further out, because Mars is just a nearby planet, the next door to us, as it were.
And I do want to talk to you about that. We have to take a quick break. Everybody stay with us. You're listening to Hot Leads, Cold Cases. My guest tonight is Dr. Chandra Wickramasinghe.
At Talent, our family treasure, we create dolls, jewelry, eggs, and decorations. We believe in beauty and kindness beyond measure. At Talent, our family treasure. Shop at talentoft.com or find us on amazon.com. At Talent, our family treasure.
What you want, you are. You always were. What you want, you are. You always were. When the plans fall, changing hands, what are the chances of winning? You hold my heart. You won't let up. After all I'm caught, touched and into fisticuffs. It's all in your head. Wonder if I'm fixed to come.
Okay, and we are back. You're listening to Hot Leads, Cold Cases. My guest tonight is Professor Wickramasinghe, who is one of the world's leading astrobiologists. And Professor, I wanted to ask you, we're talking about life on Mars, the fact that NASA is really refusing to be very cooperative in confirming its data as to extraterrestrial life. But you, in 1974, you and Sir Fred Hoyle apparently came up with the original theory of what's known as panspermia. And I know about that because I've had astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson on this show, and he was the first person who ever mentioned the word panspermia that I'd ever heard of.
Okay.
But maybe you can just really quickly explain what it is. Apparently, the idea is that dust and interstellar space is really made up of organic compounds, which is kind of strange, I think, for us to think of.
I mean, if said in that way, it does sound strange. But the astronomical evidence for dust in space being organic has grown tremendously over the last 30 years. When we first looked into this in the mid-1970s, there was quite strong evidence that the dust that you see everywhere in the clouds of the galaxy, there's the broad sort of lane of the Milky Way, and in between the stars you see various shapes, sort of dark striations like horses' heads and so on. They show up very strikingly. These structures are made of huge quantities of cosmic dust. They are... Sorry, I got a little phone peeping. Shall I say that again? Sorry about that. I better take my phone out. In the mid-1970s, the idea of organic dust in space would have sounded somewhat bizarre to most people, because they had been used to thinking that the dust in space had to be inorganic. They thought that these were little tiny ice crystals, rather like the particles of ice, microscopic particles of ice that exist in the clouds of the Earth's atmosphere. But when I looked into the details of the way these particles behave, in the way that they absorb the light from distant stars and block out the light from distant stars and so on, it was quite apparent to me that they could not be these icy particles that astronomers are talking about. And so I began to rack my brains as to what these could be, and the best fit that I could get to a whole lot of astronomical data, now this is back in the mid-70s, was for a model that was made of dust particles made of organics. Organics very similar to the kind of chemicals that we have in life. So this was published, and this was discussed and debated, and many people were very angry about it because they didn't want to think that anything resembling life existed outside the Earth. But over the years, we pursued this idea. We looked at every possible avenue to either prove or disprove the hypothesis of organic cosmic dust. And at every turn, we found that our hypothesis was backed up and not contradicted by the data that unfolded. And there was new avenues of exploration. There were new sort of telescopes that were flown around the Earth, orbiting telescopes, and every single observation, astronomical observation, supported this idea that there's organic dust in space. Now, astronomers do agree that this material, the stuff that we see as dark patches in the Milky Way, that these are largely made of organic material, that is to say carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, sort of carbonaceous material. But many of my colleagues still like to think that these can be made without life. In other words, that life is not an essential part of the process by which these so-called organic particles are made. And I and my colleagues have disputed all of that. We've argued that the only way that you could make such a huge quantity of organic material is from life itself. We know that if you put one bacterium into a nutrient medium, it makes two in a couple of hours, then two becomes four, and so on. So there's a well-known exponential multiple amplification of microorganisms that just essentially runs riot across the galaxy. Once life is somewhere, has started anywhere in the universe or anywhere in the galaxy, then it just takes over, and that's what seems to happen. The beginning of life is very difficult. I mean, that's something that we had, I had great difficulty in trying to reconcile my views with the views of the traditional biologists, because they argued that life happened on the Earth and it just happened in a primordial soup.
Well, isn't that a big problem, you know, in reconciling not only, you know, sort of the concept that life started here on Earth and maybe Darwinian theory of evolution here on Earth, and also you're running afoul of all kinds of religious concepts?
Unfortunately, that is the case, that any ideas that relate to life tend to connect with religious preconceptions, and I think one has to accept that. The conventional wisdom has been, in biology, that life started on the Earth, that life is a purely Earth-based, Earth-centered phenomenon, and that is sort of consistent with most religious positions, I think, because all religions are essentially geocentric. We think of ourselves as the most important creatures in the universe. We think the Earth is the center of things and so on. But in terms of astronomy, these ideas have been disproved a long time ago. 500 years ago, it was shown by Copernicus and Galileo that the physical situation of the Earth is not central in any way in the universe, that we have no important place in terms of the physical location of the Earth. And so reluctantly, astronomers and physicists had to agree that this is the case, that we are not at the center of things. But after that, we have still hankered after the idea that maybe life is centered on the Earth, maybe we are centered on the Earth, maybe the most important component of the universe is human life, and that is centered on the Earth. And I think these ideas are deeply religious in a very profound way, and they have to be combated, and I think that's one of the problems we face. People don't admit that it's a religious problem that they are facing, but I think it's a deeply religious problem in relation to the existence of extraterrestrial life.
I think that's absolutely true. Now, you can sort of go over, way over onto the other side of that sort of spiritual coin. There are a lot of people who claim that they've had encounters with beings not of this Earth. And you certainly, you talk to enough people involved in, you know, military programs or classified programs, and they'll talk about similar things to that. Is it possible, then, on this theory that life was brought here to Earth, did not originate here in the original compounds of this Earth, is it possible that there are complex beings, not just sort of bacteria or microbes floating around, but complex beings elsewhere out there?
I think so. It's not just possible. I think it's for certain there has to be intelligent life on a very large scale in the universe. I think to argue that we are the only intelligence, or we are even the highest intelligence in terms of life, is being pretty arrogant. There's no evidence for that, and it's only anthropocentrism and religious fervor that makes us make those statements. I have experienced I haven't experienced UFOs yet, but I have experienced, I have direct experience of looking at samples that were brought down to the Earth of microorganisms that are distinctly alien. There's no question that these have been charted on the Earth. They have not been mapped in any way, and there's a lot of evidence for that. So large creatures on other planets having intelligences greater than ours is certainly not unfeasible, and I think it's entirely likely that this is the case, that there's a huge amount of intelligence. And if that is so, then many of these stories are not to be ruled out without
taking really at least a good
evidence.
Look at them.
We need to look at the evidence.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, when you started to talk a little bit before about how you actually you gather samples of cosmic dust, and you have to. It's very specific the way you have to do it, because you apparently send up balloons that go up into the stratosphere, and as you said, 30 kilometers, which I think is 17 miles up
that
into
was,
the air.
30 kilometers was the last experiment that we did with my colleague in Sheffield. He's the principal investigator on that project. He and myself and few students, we sent up balloons to 17 miles and recovered material that we have no doubt came from space. They have fallen onto the collecting devices. They have produced craters in the collecting devices, which means that they impacted at high speed. They were not just drifting lazily in the stratosphere at 17 miles. They just bumped into this at high speed. And when these were brought down, we have organisms that are so peculiar. In fact, one organism that we have published recently has a shell of thin shell of titanium, and inside that shell of titanium there's a highly complex organic biological structure that's oozed out in the as a result of the impact. That's just one, and there's many other structures that we found in this last round of experiments. But the experiments go back to 2000, to the turn of this century, or the decade, in fact, or millennium. In fact, in 2001, I collaborated with an Indian group, the Indian Space Research Organization. We went up higher. We went up to 41 kilometers, nearly 25-30 miles, and brought down organisms, microorganisms, that we still haven't identified. In fact, the last organisms that were brought down were new to the Earth. They were not known on the Earth. And one of them was named after my distinguished colleague, Sir Fred Hoyle, called Hoylei, was one of the names that were given to this new microorganism. So there are microorganisms coming in all the time. And they're coming in, they're just flooding in at the rate of something like 1/10 of a ton.
Wow.
Every single day. Huge amount.
Incredible. We've got to take another quick break. Everybody stay with us. You're listening to Hot Leads, Cold Cases. My guest tonight is Chandra Wickramasinghe.
At Talent, our family treasure, we create dolls, jewelry, eggs, and decorations. We believe in beauty and kindness beyond measure. At Talent, our family treasure. Shop at talentoft.com or find us on amazon.com at Talent, our family treasure.
Tried to beat you, but you're so hot that I melted. I fell right through the cracks. Now I'm trying to get back. Before the cool done run out, I'll be giving it my best. This and nothing's gonna stop me but divine intervention. I reckon it's again my turn to win some or learn some. But I won't hesitate no more, no more. It cannot wait. I'm yours. Well, open up your mind and see like me. Open up your plans and damn, you're free. I look into your heart and you'll find love. And sing. We're just one big family, and it's our godforsaken right to be loved. Love, 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 love. So why won't they stop taking? Checking my tongue in the mirror and bending over backwards just to try to see it clearer, but my breath fogged up the glass, and so I drew a new face and I laughed. I guess what I'll be saying is there ain't no better reason to rid yourself of vanities and just go with the seasons. It's what we aim to do. Our name is our virtue, but I won't hesitate no more, no more. It cannot wait.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Hot Leads Cold Cases. My guest tonight is Professor Chandra Wickramasinghe. So we were talking before the break, Professor, about tons and tons of organic biological organisms being sort of rained down on us on apparently a regular basis here on Earth. Now, you actually first came to my attention when I saw you on a TV show, and you were talking about the strange case of the red rain in India. And that was something, let's see, that happened, it went on for about 2 months, from July to September in 2001. There was blood red rain that fell in torrential downpours in the Indian state of Kerala, and it would do things. It stained clothing red. It was kind of scary looking. Some people theorized that it was the result of a meteor explosion. Finally, the Indian government commissioned a study, and they concluded that the rain was red because of little airborne spores that came from earth algae. 5 years later, in 2006, some scientists began to argue that these colored particles were actually extraterrestrial cells, and I'm assuming that you were with that group.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we have looked at this rain, red rain cells from Kerala now for close to a decade, and still it hasn't been resolved what these are. They're certainly not the kind of algal cells that one sees on the internet, and there's been a sort of a large-scale whitewashing of the whole thing to say that, oh, this is very easy to understand. There's just algal cells that were blown up in vast quantities from the trees, and they went into the clouds, and they came back again. And that's not the case at all. We have looked at algal cells, the alleged algal cells, under the microscope. We've studied them in every possible way. They are nowhere like the red rain cells that fell from the skies. The rain fell after a huge sonic boom. It was heard right across the whole state of Kerala. And I think there's every indication that it came from space, that there was a small fragment of a comet containing these microorganisms and maybe other microbes as well that exploded in the stratosphere and essentially fed the clouds, the rain clouds, with this red material. So that was in 2001, but the same kind of situation was repeated in Sri Lanka last year, about almost a year ago. Mm-hmm. And I've been involved in studies of this as well. And the two types of particles, the red rain of Kerala, red rain particles of Kerala, and the red rain particles of Sri Lanka are very similar. And I think one has to draw the conclusion that they must also have come from a cometary source. Why is it only in Kerala and India? The answer to that I really do not know for sure, But I tend to think that even in the United States, in New York, if there's a light fall of rain with a slightly colored red color, you wouldn't notice it. It had to be very, very dark red before you noticed it. So I suspect that if you look at the rainfalls in many places at many times, you might have the red rain phenomenon in a dilute form. And it's also worth mentioning that accounts of red rain really span a long historical period from almost sort of prehistory to the present time. Homer's Iliad, for instance, is an epic poem, and he describes blood falling from the skies. In biblical,
yes, it has a biblical sound to it, and it's sort of spooky that way.
It is, yeah. There's biblical accounts of rain falling, red blood falling from the skies. Right through history, this has happened. And when you begin to look at the timings of these events, there's also a rather uncanny correlation between meteor sightings and meteor falls that are recorded and the red rain events. So I tend to think that this is just one phenomenon that is certainly colorful because it's red and it shows up, but microorganisms are coming in all the time, and every pandemic of history has been driven from outside. And that's, I firmly believe that we cannot understand the history of epidemics without admitting that some component of microorganisms, viruses or bacteria have fallen from the skies.
I want to get to that in a second, but I do want to go back a little bit because in researching this, I thought it was very interesting that the exact same region in India apparently has had many of these red rainfalls going back to, I think it was 1897, and they had them even after this recorded event in 2001. I think it was again in 2012. So it just keeps happening, and it's odd. I think it's peculiar, as you were saying, that it seems to happen in that particular region. Do you think it has something to do with the fact that it's so close to the equator?
It's close to the equator. Its geographical location has to be considered as an important factor. It is also the meteorological conditions in that part of the world are also quite peculiar, and it could be that swirling clouds in that over that area in Sri Lanka and India tend to collect and to retain particles that fell from comets longer than in the temperate latitudes like in London or in New York. Something like that has to operate, but I keep getting letters from people all over the place in the United States, North America, South America, in Devon, in southern England, saying that people have had their ponds, you know, where they have little either bird baths or ponds, suddenly go pink overnight, and they've sent me samples. I haven't really had the resources to look at these samples, but I think it happens. In a dilute form, this red rain must be falling almost everywhere from time to time.
Well, it's kind of, I don't recall ever seeing red rain. And when I saw the footage of some of that rain that was coming down in India, oh, my goodness. And it really did look like blood. It was very spooky looking. But they also apparently have reported black rain, yellow rain, green rain. Have you seen all of that?
Yes, yes. Yes, I have. I have seen the yellow rain. I have seen. I haven't seen the black rain, but the yellow rain was reported about 2 or 3 weeks after the red rain. So I think it's just a matter of degree of pigmentation. When the red rain has been around, red rain cells have been around, exposed to the ultraviolet for a long time. Maybe the pigment fades. I don't know what the details are, but I think the fact is that to this day we have no clear knowledge of what the red rain cells really are. They are not recognizable terrestrial algal cells, although the nearest type of earth cell that resembles the red rain cells to some degree are algae, like the algae that you get in the trees. But when you begin to compare, make detailed comparisons, the differences are quite profound.
What about in 1994, I don't know if you've heard about this, the residents of a small town in the state of Washington, here in the U.S., in a town called Oakville, they reported seeing material raining down from the sky. They described it as little clear blobs of this sort of jelly-like material the size of grains of rice. Some people who handled it ended up in the hospital with nausea or dizziness or kind of odd symptoms. I think there were some reports of some kittens eating it and they died. There was a local skeptical doctor who decided to send the material off to a lab to have it analyzed. And when it came back, they discovered from their analysis that it included human white blood cells. So the doctor then said, well, you know, it must come from waste from an airplane toilet system or waste system that dumped, you know, somehow unexpectedly. And that would explain the presence of the human cells. But airplane waste fluid is blue. Did you hear about that? Have you looked into similar cases? Would that be the same kind of thing as the different colored rains, or are we talking about something different?
Yeah. I would tend to think that they're related in a generic sort of way. I haven't experienced them personally, anything like that, but I've seen documentaries on, they call it star jelly, isn't it? It's happened in Scotland, it's happened in Northern Europe and so on. So it's not a new phenomenon. That also is like the red rain that's happened in the last several decades. It has been reported sporadically. So I think it could be just this similar bits that fall from comets. Comets, we know, are made of organic material, have a large component of organics, and jelly-like substances are indeed organic. Now, the human contamination is another issue that you brought up, and I don't know. I think handling of this material, when you take it to the lab, you have introduced some contamination. So the argument that the entire sample was just human contamination, it probably is being a little oversimplistic. It's not entirely clear to me that the analysis that you referred to disproved a non-terrestrial origin of the jelly that was brought to the laboratory.
What about, people have talked about these strange water spouts that sometimes occur in the ocean. They're like giant whirlpools, I guess, and then they spout out and they scoop up all of the fish. So suddenly you've got thousands of fish that are up in the air and then being transported by the wind and then end up landing. Is it possible this could be something similar to that?
I mean, I've thought about that. I think those water spouts and the fish, rain of fish, is probably another, a totally different phenomenon. I think this...
Maybe that's another biblical event.
It's a biblical event, but it probably is not every biblical event needs to be connected with the skies, isn't it? It probably happened in the oceans. The oceans have currents that we don't entirely understand. The ocean currents and deep ocean currents are still essentially uncharted territory to a large extent. So occasionally you could have, and there are thermal springs and all kinds of things happening in the deep ocean. So you could have spouts suddenly developing that carries up the fish to very great heights and deposits them. But they wouldn't go to the kind of heights that we have recovered these bizarre microorganisms in the stratosphere at 17 miles. If you throw up a fish, it doesn't go up more than it has a very, very low altitude maximum height, and it comes down.
I wouldn't know. I haven't thrown too many fish up in the air. Hang on. We got to take another quick break. You're listening to Hot Leads, Cold Cases. My guest tonight is Professor Chandra Wickramasinghe.
At Talent, our family treasure, we create dolls, jewelry, eggs, and decorations. We believe in beauty and kindness beyond measure. At Talent, our family treasure. Shop at talentoft.com or find us on amazon.com. At Talent, our family treasure.
hasn't stopped raining for days. My world is a flood. Slowly I become one with the mud.
But if I can't swim after 40 days, then my mind is crushed by the crashing waves that feel so high that I cannot fall. Lift me up, whoa. Lift me up.
When I'm falling,
lift me up.
We can die. Crashing in the ocean, I'm losing control. Dark sky all around. Can't feel my feet touching the ground.
But if I can't swim after 40 days, then my mind is crushed by the crashing waves that feel so high that I cannot fall and feel low. Lift me up.
Welcome back, everybody. My guest tonight is Professor Chandra Wickramasinghe, and we've been sort of taking the tour of the universe this evening. Kind of interesting. I would like to just talk a little bit, while we still have some time left, about what you think the effects of all of this strange biological, organic material raining down on the Earth on a regular basis. What effect does that have on us as human beings, if any?
Oh, I think it has a profound effect. I really believe that if not for the rain of microorganisms that happens all the time and has happened right from the beginning of the Earth's formation, we wouldn't be here. The first microorganisms were brought by comets impacting the Earth some 4 billion years ago. We know that for sure, because we have rocks that carry the signatures of these organisms. If there were no further introductions of viruses or bacteria or microbes, then there would only be microbes on the Earth. We wouldn't be there. We wouldn't be here. The continuing rain of microorganisms, continuing rain of genetic material from space was, in fact, what led to the emergence of all of the life that we see on the Earth. The whole spectrum of biological evolution is a result of this continuing rain from the skies, from the universe. The entire galaxy, according in this picture, is a single connected biosphere. Now, we think of our biosphere as sort of limited to the Earth, but it's nowhere like that. I think the whole of the galaxy is connected. And we have just been pieced together, or the whole spectrum of life, this marvelous spectacle of life that we see around us is just fragments that have got together, like the red rain, cells falling from the skies, like these viruses and microbes that are falling from the skies, they have been pieced together, and selection of according to fittest and so on has taken place, and that's what we see as life today. That is very, very clearly evident now from DNA studies, because even the human genome is known to have a huge component, maybe 50% of our human genome is made up of viruses. Viruses that were inserted over the last 4 or 5 million years in our evolution from anthropoids and apes and anthropoids and so on. So what happened was that these little viruses like the AIDS virus, they came at various times, maybe every few thousand years or so, nearly completely or almost completely culled the evolving line. They destroyed every individual except maybe a very small residual breeding group that went through carrying this residual virus. And these viruses, I think, that are carried through in our evolution essentially is the storehouse for evolutionary information that led to our evolution.
So we're primarily viral.
We are more than 90% viral in our makeup, and that you can't get away from that. I think there has been a book written by Frank Ryan, I think was the author, called Virolution, which is a new word, which is a revolution in biology, where viruses are the key to everything. And they came from space, and these are the bits and pieces that we see everywhere. They fall from the skies, and they are in the oceans, and so on.
So are we in danger from these alien viruses falling to Earth? I mean, is that a problem for us, or do we just sort of absorb them naturally?
It is a problem. If you think of our individual existence and individual survival, viruses, on the average, are bad for us. Because you have a cold now and you're sneezing and coughing. I might have flu and I might be laid in bed. I might, as a result of flu, many people even die, right? But it's the survivors that matter. The survivors carry the information of the virus onto the next generation and thereafter onto the next generation and so on. And those are the that's the evolutionary storehouse of information. So I think the viruses are important. If viruses were bad for us, isn't it remarkable that in the long evolutionary history of animals like ourselves, we have not developed total immunity to viruses? You would have thought that a virus is a tiny, tiny piece of information compared to the huge information in our genes. And it should be logically possible for the massive information content in our cells to somehow devise to block out the viruses that are coming in. On the contrary, and this is very amazing, I think, I find it very amazing that we seem to invite viruses. We have attachment sites on our cells, on our throat cells, respiratory cells, and so on, inviting these viruses. And that wouldn't happen if viruses are bad for us in a sort of global sense, in terms of evolution. Evolution and viruses go hand in hand. That's the crux of the matter.
Isn't that, I mean, I just think that whole topic is really fascinating. So you don't think there's really a risk of there being anything, you know, a pandemic or anything like that as a result of what's coming in on this, you know, riding in on the cosmic dust?
I think there is a risk. I think every pandemic of history has been driven from space. There have been so many pandemics. The last major pandemic was in 1918, 1919, when some 30 million people worldwide died. And this was an influenza pandemic. And it happened on the first attacks of this pandemic, this really lethal strain of influenza, happened in Boston and Bombay on the same day. Hmm. You cannot explain that in terms of any sort of person-to-person Earth theory, Earthbound theory.
Yeah.
It had to come from space. It had to fall in on these two different places and then spread in a higgledy-piggledy fashion from those places. And every single historical epidemic, I think, was driven from space, and it'll happen again. There's no question about it. But one of the things that I have suggested to many people, and they're beginning to think semi-seriously about it, is to have some kind of virus shield in the stratosphere, where we send up balloons or maybe satellites and collect these viruses that are falling in, and before they cause havoc, it may be possible to devise vaccines and immunize large numbers of people against the impending doom, if that is to be the case. But I think the possibilities are there. They're quite real. And they are being talked about. The next flu pandemic has been seriously talked about by experts the world over. They don't know what to do about it, but they keep talking about it.
I think that the idea of having a global shield, a viral shield, is fascinating. And I would think that NASA would want to be paying much more attention to your Freedom of Information request.
They should be.
To be finding out about what's really out there, unless they don't want us to know about it. But we, unfortunately, we're at the end of our show, and I just want to make sure that if people would like to get a hold of you, contact you, find out about your work, your books, pick up a copy of your autobiography, A Destiny of Cosmic Life, how would they go about doing that?
Well, Amazon is the place to go for it. It hasn't been put out on Amazon yet, but the publication date is the 20th of January, which is my birthday. It's been printed in Sri Lanka, of all places, which is also my birthplace. And the book will be sold on Amazon. And I think it's a paperback. It's not very expensive, but that's my latest book. But Amazon is probably the best place to buy get all the other books that I've written in large numbers. Many of them are out of print, however. But if your listeners want to know about me, then the website the Buckingham Center for Astrobiology website is one place to go for, and drchandra.org is another website that has details of my activities.
Well, that's a lot easier than pronouncing or writing Wick Ramasinghe. But thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. I really appreciate it. Happy birthday in advance.
Thank you.
I wish you all good things. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Good night, everybody.